Hey everybody, a little bit of a rant here. Kind of a weird evening. So, in my earlier podcast episode today, I talked about how a friend of mine, a Buddhist friend of mine in the Midwest, and I had set up an online Zoom meeting as an introduction to Nichiren Buddhism. And so I knew it was going to be a little bit odd just because my friend, who, like me, is a member of a Nichiren Shoshu temple. And so despite my, you know, atheist, secular, belief system, I'm a member of, or I have been a member of that ultra-Orthodox temple, and my friend is what I would say ultra-Orthodox Nichiren Shoshu Buddhist, and I guess up until now I would have classified myself as a secular non-Orthodox Nichiren Shoshu Buddhist. but it became, it was already becoming clear, because I've been, I've classified myself certainly as an atheist for decades. But also having been reading Buddhist literature, or what some Buddhists call scriptures, what I call Buddhist philosophy and ethics, sometimes told in the form of parables with lots of metaphors and symbolism and allegorical characters and events and situations. But the Nichiren Shoshu school of Buddhism pushes, it's very theistic to me, and it's, lots of kind of supernatural stuff and not very science or fact-based. But anyways, despite some of that critique, I have found some parts of it, very positive. So the focus on the Lotus Sutra, which was Siddhartha Gautama Buddha's last teaching, and you could say it's his last greatest, most cumulative teaching over all the iterative teachings he'd been giving throughout India for, 50 or 60 years, until he died at age 80, culminating in the Lotus Sutra. So I found that comforting, and the ritualized chanting meditation, what they call prayers, which I continued to call meditation, really kind of works for me, and I think it works actually for a lot of people, and that's whether, they're chanting parts or all of the Lotus Sutra, or whether they're chanting, the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra, or, other types of mantras. I think even just from a non-religious perspective, chanting with meditation has certain effects on the brain, which are helpful for relaxation, de-stressing, anxiety, clearing the mind to be able to focus on more appropriate things with better intent, with better success. So I think those things have been great for me, but you know, during this online Zoom meeting that we had tonight, our Nichiren Shoshu priest intervened somewhat abruptly, and what I would say kind of rudely, actually, which kind of surprised me because he's, you know, native Japanese, and I find Japanese people just kind of culturally to be very polite, right? Excuse me. And so he insisted that we halt our Zoom meeting, and that my friend and I, along with the, I don't know, I think maybe we had five other participants, you know, hang up our Zoom meeting and join his. And so my friend, who was being texted by the priest, agreed to do that. Had he contacted me, I would have said no, you know. We'd be glad to join your meeting after we finish ours. Just because I felt like it was impolite to people who had set aside their time for this meeting that we had planned. So we jump into the temple's Zoom meeting, and then there's like this person, a member, she may be a leader in the temple, I'm not quite sure, because a lot of that's not really public information. But so we jumped in, and so she had this very heavy, like, PowerPoint slide presentation, and it was, I think it was taking place in Minnesota, and it was for her Shakabuku, the people whom she had shakabuku'd. And shakabuku is just a very strange concept to me. Shakabuku is the Japanese word essentially for aggressive proselytizing or evangelizing. So maybe like an analogy here, at least in the United States or in the Western world, would be, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons who come and knock on your door and are very pushy and, you know, in their attempts to convert people. So I don't believe in shakabuku, and I don't think it's very nice. And it comes across as extremely authoritarian and snooty. So I certainly don't have a problem with talking to people about, you know, Buddha, Buddhism, the Dharma, you know, which are Buddha's teachings, but not in an extremely dogmatic or doctrinaire way. So we join this meeting, and so this lady is giving this PowerPoint presentation, and she forcefully mutes all of our microphones, and she's in a very kind of authoritarian, you know, reminded me as a kid, I grew up Christian in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which is kind of a, you know, the ultra-Orthodox version of Lutheranism in the U.S., and, you know, going through catechism class and to go through confirmation and having to memorize, you know, Luther's small catechism and, and then, you know, having to respond at the confirmation ceremony, you know, picked on one by one, to have to recite, you know, some rather large parts of the catechism in order to be confirmed. And it was, you know, the pastor at the time was a very nice guy, but it still came across as very kind of indoctrination, you know, this is what it is and don't ask any questions, you know. And so I guess maybe I guess because I'm also a socialist and a Marxist, you know, I'm more used to, I guess, you know, the fancy term for it would be kind of dialectical polemics, you know, where you have question and answers, and then you kind of debate them, and then you use logic, and then you, you know, you work through it, right? I mean, not in a mean way or an aggressive way, but it's just kind of like a back and forth, kind of similar to a debate, to arrive at a solution or an answer. And so inside of, you know, my experience inside of Nichiren Shoshu for the past few years has just been the exact opposite. It's very top-down, it's very patriarchal, it's, you know, all of the priests are native Japanese men, you know, ordained in Japan and then kind of sent all over the world, including the United States, to be priests in the various temples that exist. And it's, even though I highly respect, you know, I love, even though I've never been to Japan, but I mean, I love Japanese, what I know of Japanese culture and, you know, the Japanese people that I've met in my life, living in big cities and traveling, you know, I've always just loved them. They're wonderful people. But for whatever reason, the priests inside of Nichiren Shoshu, and granted I've only, you know, really interacted with two, my current priest and then the former priest, and just very authoritarian and undemocratic and just the patriarchy and the lineages and the, you know, women in subservient roles, and it really kind of clashes with my values, I guess. So I guess, like, during this debacle that happened tonight with our online meeting, which was meant to be an introduction to Nichiren, you know, my friend and I kind of compromised on a title of Introduction to Nichiren Buddhism. You know, and in the discussion, I mean, I knew that she would be coming from a very dogmatic, you know, ultra-Orthodox approach or perspective, which is her, you know, I respect her belief system, even though I don't share it. And that I would kind of be giving counterpoints on the, you know, the non-theistic kind of secular side. You know, that was all halted like 5 minutes into the meeting by this command from the priest to halt what we were doing and to jump into his thing with this lady who was acting, you know, she was acting like, I mean, I never went to Catholic school, but she reminded me of what my friends who went to Catholic school told me, you know, the lady that, you know, the nun that walks around with the big, you know, the head covering with the ruler in her hand, and if you get something wrong, she, like, takes the ruler and, like, whacks your hand, you know? And I was like, this is just really strange, you know? And so my friends, from my Facebook network that I had invited to this meeting and who also jumped over, or at least most of them, jumped over into the temple meeting, I mean, I just, you know, I mean, they were polite about it when I spoke to them afterwards, but it was really, I mean, I didn't like it, and I don't think they did either. My friend, who, you know, my Buddhist friend in the Midwest, who I had set up our meeting with, just kind of went along with it, you know, just because that's what you do. If the priest says something, you know, asks you to jump, you say, how high? You know, you don't ever question or say, well, you know, Reverend, you know, I'm busy right now. Could we join your meeting later after we finish our meeting? Or, you know, there's no room for compromise or for questioning or any of that. And so, I mean, I was pretty upset, or, well, I wasn't angry. I was just a little frustrated, and it, you know, it just kind of added to the frustrations that I've been feeling over the past year or so with, you know, my Nichiren Choshu temple and interacting with the priests and, you know, and then various discussions around, you know, dogma and doctrine and, you know, the Gahanzan, and then, you know, the Gahanzan's an object of worship, and it's a piece of parchment paper or wood that has these inscriptions on it that Nichiren Shonin kind of invented and, you know, made the original ones himself, and then his followers or disciples or priests kind of copied his style, and then, you know, there's this whole lineage of who is allowed to inscribe these Gahanzans. And, you know, certainly, I mean, I respect the Gahanzans as sort of a symbol of, you know, Buddhist teachings, even though there's a lot of allegorical stuff in there and mythical stuff and protectors and, there's even some Shintoism, language in there, you know, and it's all in Japanese calligraphy characters. And, oh, and maybe a little bit of Sanskrit and some Chinese as well. So unless you're a scholar or something in those languages, I mean, even looking at the Gahanzan, you don't really understand all the things that are in it, right? I mean, it's a whole, you know, there could be a whole university course on, you know, a whole semester on the content in the Gahanzan and what language it's in and why it's in that language and what symbolism is used and, you know, what's literal and what's symbolic and all of that. So, but I've just really tired of hearing about, you know, the magic powers of the Gahanzan and praying to the Gahanzan. And then I had another conversation with my friend today, who I love, but, you know, she was talking about making offerings to the Gahanzan on the altar and, you know, offering the Gahanzan water and rice and bananas and things like that. And I, you know, and so we were talking and I was like, well, I mean, you can't actually believe this is literal, right? I mean, the Gahanzan is not a living thing. It's just a piece of paper with symbols on it that, I mean, sure, can be revered, you know. I think I made a comparison in earlier podcast episode about how, you know, I have a painting of my late mom on my wall, who is, you know, sitting in my apartment that I used to have in San Francisco, holding my dog, who has also since passed away. And, you know, so, I mean, I revere that, I revere and protect that painting and that canvas, you know, and I like looking at it, but you know, my mom and my little dog Spider, I mean, they're not in that, you know, they're not in that canvas. They're, you know, the canvas is just a symbol of them to remind me about who they were when they were alive, right? I mean, I'm not putting out I'm not offering, you know, like some of my mom's favorite foods, like chocolate. You know, I'm not putting chocolate in front of her painting. I mean, I'm not trying to be slanderous or disrespectful toward, you know, the Nichiren Choshu School of Buddhism, or toward the priest, or even towards, especially towards my friend. But, I mean, it's like some of this stuff is just so ridiculous to me, as an atheist, and as a person who, you know, is well-educated, and, you know, I try to base my life on, you know, things like facts and science and evidence and, you know, logic. So it just, I think today it just kind of culminated, like it was kind of like the last straw. It was like, I mean, I stayed in this, you know, meeting that we got hijacked into with the, you know, this authoritarian lady who was teaching, and, you know, with the PowerPoint slides that were, you know, so detailed and going into such levels of, like, dogma and doctrine and, you know, all this stuff. And it's like, you know, I don't know exactly how my friends felt that joined the meeting, but I was like, you know, for somebody who's an absolute new person to Buddhism in general, and then maybe especially new to Nichiren Choshu Buddhism, I mean, immediately jumping into all these things about, you know, Daimoku and the Lotus Sutra and, you know, the ringing of the bells and the rituals and all this stuff. And it's like, well, okay, like, hold on for a second. I mean, shouldn't we back up and kind of explain, like, what Buddhism, you know, like, start at, like, the 3,000 foot level, right? And kind of say, okay, so what is Buddhism? Well, Buddhism is a set of teachings, philosophy, ethics, beliefs, value systems, behaviors that are based on Siddhartha Gautama Buddha's teachings. And then, you know, from there you kind of maybe would go through some of his first core teachings, like the three jewels or the three treasures, as they're sometimes called, which are, you know, the, you know, taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, which are his teachings, and Sangha, which is community. And then going into the Four Noble Truths, and then expanding that into the Eightfold Path. And then, you know, just the sheer basics, right, about just the core, what the core of Buddha was, who he was, you know, this super rich royal aristocrat, you know, spoiled rotten, and who at an early age, I can't remember what age, but, you know, like 20 or in his early 20s, and he, you know, went outside the palace gates and, you know, he just saw all this suffering in the world and poverty and, you know, crippled people and hungry people and beggars and, you know, just misery and suffering, right? And which he had never seen, because living inside the palace walls, which he evidently had never left before, you know, it was the ultimate in luxury, you know, gold, everything, you know, servants, you know, lavish meals, you know, the best of everything. So, just kind of really, I think, to, you know, to teach newcomers about Buddhism, you kind of have to start at the beginning, not the end. You know, the Lotus Sutra is kind of like his final teaching. I mean, but, you know, and sure, it's cumulative, and it's kind of the, you know, the, because it's cumulative, it kind of sort of covers all his previous teachings, but I mean, it's very complex and in the way it's written, and it's, you know, prose and prosaic and, you know, lots of allegorical stuff, and it's just, you know, it's heavy reading. And even the English translation of it still has a lot of Sanskrit and Pali words in it. And so, you know, it's something you need to work up to. And so I was just really confused in like 5 or 7 minutes. And then I was like, you know, I kept trying to raise my hand in the Zoom meeting and try and figure out, like, what's going on? I thought we were having a meeting with the priest, and who's this lady? And why are we having these, like, you know, it was kind of like we needed to be having like a, you know, Buddhism 101 course, right? And my friend and I had decided that ours was going to be managed in a very, you know, casual, conversational way, trying to understand who all the meeting participants were, you know, getting to know them, what backgrounds they came from, you know, why were they interested in Buddhism, and then jumping into like the Buddhism 101 things and explaining like who Buddha was and, you know, what his first kind of core teachings were, and then kind of expand on that, right? And then maybe, you know, but not jump right into like the graduate level 800 level PhD course, which seemed to be what happened today. And it was just, it was very strange. And so I actually dropped out of the call and, you know, took a deep breath and meditated for a moment. I wasn't angry. I was just frustrated. And, you know, I called the temple and I spoke to the reverend's wife, and I was very soft-spoken and diplomatic and nice and polite, and so was she. But, you know, it was just mass confusion. And I think on their end, the mass confusion was the fact that I was confused. Like, in other words, I should just always do whatever the priest says. I shouldn't be questioning anything. And that just, you know, doesn't work for me. I, you know, it's like, and I, you know, the reverend is a really nice guy, and I've had, you know, a telephone conversation with him, and he was super, you know, just much nicer than the previous priest that we had, and much more personable. But I mean, he still carries that, you know, and maybe it's just from being in the, you know, I think that some of these priests start when they're 12 years old and going to kind of like Buddhist seminary and, you know, being kind of monks and, you know, kind of this very monastic, controlled, patriarchal, authoritarian life. And so when they come out into the real world and they're priests in the temple, I mean, maybe culturally that works better in Japan because maybe Japanese people are more accustomed to it. Because, I mean, obviously there are more Buddhists in Japan than there are in the U.S. But, you know, here that kind of doesn't work. I mean, or in Germany or France or the U.K. or, I mean, really anywhere in the Western world. Or really maybe even anywhere outside of Japan. I don't know. And so, you know, I mean, it's like talking to them, it's like, you know, and even looking at them, it's like, you know, they're still stuck like in the 13th century when Nichiren Shonin or Nichiren Daishonin, depending on, you know, which title you prefer, the founder of Nichiren Buddhism, lived. And it, you know, this is not the 13th century. This is also not Japan. You know, we don't have samurais and shoguns and, you know, all this stuff. And this is the 21st century. And we really need, you know, a way of conveying Buddhist philosophy and ethics and practices as kind of, you know, as kind of a choice for a way of life, of, you know, self-improvement or, you know, health and wellness and, you know, helping yourself so that you can help other people, to ease suffering in the world, and, you know, kind of like this just kind of caring, compassionate, empathy-filled, you know, a approach to life with compassion and, you know, all of that good stuff, right? And so it's like, it all just seems to get like buried under just like mountains of this just, you know, dogma and beliefs and supernatural stuff and magic and, you know, which way you have to light the incense, and the incense burner has to be on the right hand side of the altar table, not the left side. And, you know, if you want to say a memorial for, you know, like a deceased relative, you know, like I wanted to, even though I didn't fully understand that it really was a Shinto, there's a lot of Shintoism that got imported into Nichiren Shoshu, or the Nichiren School of Buddhism, which I don't really support, not out of disrespect for Japanese culture, but just because, again, because I'm an atheist and non-theistic, you know, I don't believe in deities or offerings of incense or food or, you know, praying to the dead or for the dead, or, you know, there's, I mean, in my non-theistic world, there's no one to pray to. There's no one to worship. There's nothing to worship or pray to. It's, you know, our life is our life. And we're kind of the masters of our own destiny, and we're kind of responsible for ourselves, you know, in trying to be the, you know, the best self that we can be, right? I mean, not that we can be perfect. I mean, you know, we're flawed as humans. But, you know, in trying to help others and ease suffering and, you know, compassion, empathy, mutual aid, you know, all these things, especially during a global pandemic that we haven't seen the likes of in 100 years, right? And so just during this class that we got hijacked into with the Nazi-like, nun-like teacher, I mean, it was just like too much. I was just like, what is going on? Like, people are dying and suffering, and, you know, just here in the United States, there's like 40 million unemployed and literal bread lines, and people can't afford to eat, and, you know, and we're supposed to be teaching Buddhism about compassion and, you know, ethical behavior and, yeah, it just was very odd to me. And so I, you know, like I was saying, I dropped off the call and spoke to the reverend's wife, and, you know, I did apologize. I said, you know, I'm sorry for the confusion, like I said earlier, but, you know, I mean, the confusion was not caused by me. The confusion was not caused by my friend, my Buddhist big sister, even though she and I, you know, have some differences in our belief systems, in Buddhism, but, you know, it was caused by the priest. And even the lady who was teaching the course in his Zoom conference, like, when we jumped into the conference, like, she didn't know who in the heck we were. You know, she was like, Justin, who? You know? And so I kept, like, doing the little raise hand thing, you know, to, like, introduce myself. And she, you know, was, like, not having it. I mean, she was just, like, muting everyone, and she was like, you know, I'm in command, I'm talking, everybody else shut up. I mean, it was just, it was very authoritarian, extremely undemocratic, not friendly at all. I mean, it just was crazy. And so I kind of decided, and I don't know how I'm going to approach it. I mean, I'm going to meditate just because that helps clear my mind and, you know, so that I don't do rash things, you know. But I have to... sorry. My dogs are going crazy. Sorry. It'll go away in a second. Okay. They heard a noise in the backyard. I have to just figure out a way to disconnect myself from Nichiren Shoshu. I'm, you know, so even though I'm a Gojikide, officially Gojikide, which is kind of like baptized in Christianity, even though I'm a Gojikide member, an official member, I think I'm just going to have to cancel or retract my membership in Nichiren Shoshu. I mean, at my temple, and then in general, just continue along with this path of secular Buddhism, which, to the best of my knowledge, and I've been, you know, studying this for the past few years, is you know, kind of a grassroots movement that's growing. But as far as I know, there aren't any official, you know, there have... Sorry. I don't know why my dog is going so nuts. I think the neighbor is out in their backyard or something. She seems to know when I'm on the phone or when I'm doing a recording, and that's when she gets super talkative. But anyways, my apologies. So where was I? Oh, so yeah, so I need to end it, because it's just not going to work out, because I just cannot accept all this you know, not only all these, like, unscientific, supernatural, magic, deity things, but also just kind of like this dictatorial, authoritarian, patriarchal, and I also see it as somewhat misogynistic, you know, putting women in, like, a subservient position and stuff. It's really just unappealing to my values, and I think it would be to most people who hold modern, you know, let's call them progressive or liberal values. So, I had to ask myself tonight, it's like, wait a second. I mean, I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I'm a Democratic Socialist and have been since I was like 15. And I'm 54 now, so, you know, that's almost, that's 39 years. And a Marxist. And so, you know, is it like, wait a second, did I somehow kind of like accidentally get kind of like sucked into like the Republican version of Buddhism? You know, I mean, and I'm not saying that to be disrespectful to Nichiren Shoshu, but I'm just saying, like, I'm not a conservative person, and it just seems like I'm in a Buddhist temple, which is, you know, a subset of a school of Buddhism that seems to just be hyper-conservative. And so, anyway, sorry to rant. Thanks for listening. But I know that other Buddhists go through similar things, and I think that even people in other faiths, right, like Christianity, you know, it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, people convert or change, you know, from being Baptist to Pentecostal to Methodist or Presbyterian, or from Catholic to, you know, Greek Orthodox, or from Catholic to Jewish, or from Jewish to Muslim, or, you know, whatever the case may be, right? I mean, people have to, you know, find their own paths, and I respect that. I don't, even though I may not agree with a value system or, you know, beliefs of, you know, certain other religions or even philosophies, that doesn't mean that I disrespect the people who hold those values. I mean, because they're in a democratic world society, they're, unless they're actually harming someone, I think they're entitled, you know, kind of like free speech, to believe what they want and practice their religion how they want. And so, but I also think that applies to me. So, you know, being an atheist, and then also philosophically and ethically a Buddhist, the secular Buddhism grassroots movement is where I need to be. And so I think that there's a need, you know, and I'm not saying this from an egotistical point of view, but I'm just saying, like, there doesn't seem to be any kind of formalized, you know, sanghas or temples or communities or, you know, whatever the case may be, inside this secular Buddhist movement. And, you know, I think we kind of all connect on the internet, and, you know, it's kind of like almost like a secret society, like closet atheist Buddhists, you know, talking on Telegram or something, you know, encrypted messenger or something on the internet. I mean, I think it's time to come out of the closet. I mean, even though I'm queer, I've never been in the closet, you know. I don't believe in being in the closet. I just believe in being who you are, you know, as long as you're not hurting other people. So I think, yeah, so my plan is to figure out a kind way to separate myself from Nichiren Shoshu and that whole indoctrination, ultra-Orthodox conservative environment, and to just proceed along with secular Buddhism and, you know, try to help create this, you know, what I've dubbed secular Lotus Buddhism, which is basically secular Buddhism that is based on the Mahayana tradition. And for those who don't know, that's a whole other show to explain Mahayana Buddhism versus Theravada and some other schools. There's so many different, like, levels and matrices and, you know, separations. But I mean, basically, secular Lotus Buddhism is secular Buddhism based on, you know, maybe with kind of a focus on the Lotus Sutra, because that was Buddha's final greatest kind of accumulation of all of his teachings, as he said in the Lotus Sutra. And, you know, also all of his other, you know, incorporating his other direct teachings that he gave kind of along the way, iteratively up until the Lotus Sutra. I don't think that means, however, incorporating, because at the time, a lot of that was passed along by oral tradition, and a lot of the sutras and the parables that Buddha spoke or gave
weren't written down until well after his death. I think, you know, a century or two after. And some of the sutras weren't written down, were passed along by oral tradition only, and didn't get written down into Sanskrit or Pali languages until even much later. And so, you know, I had a discussion with, you know, my Buddhist big sister, today, trying to explain my point of view. And I said, you know, a lot of this stuff was passed along by oral tradition. And, you know, it's kind of like, I think I mentioned this in the previous podcast episode, but the telephone game, right? Where you have 10 children standing in, you know, single file, let's just say 10, 12 year olds. And the child in the front of the line comes up with maybe a short, you know, 1 or 2 minute story, fiction. Or it could even be nonfiction. It could just be a set of facts or something, right? And repeat it quietly to the kid behind him or her, and then keep going back the chain. And then by the time the 10th kid or the final kid in the line is asked by the teacher to repeat what he just heard from the 9th child, it's totally different from the story that the child in the front of the line told. I mean, I think this is just human nature, right? It's not like there was any evil intent or whatever. It's just, you know, memories get fuzzy, people fill in blanks, you know, they mistake one word for another word. Some people like to kind of exaggerate, you know, or ad hoc, you know, and so, you know, some of the, you know, many of Buddha's core teachings are kind of repeated, in multiple sources, and so that makes them a little bit more authoritative, right? That they were actually spoken that way. But as you get further and further away, because, you know, Buddha was living 24 to 2500 years ago, and then, you know, by the time we get to Nichiren Shonin or Nichiren Daishonin, who, you know, by the time Buddhism spread to Japan, and, you know, he started, you know, formulating these ideas around the Lotus Sutra and coming up with, you know, very kind of orthodox like doctrines, and in fact declaring himself to be a Buddha. You know, there's some megalomania, narcissism maybe a little bit involved there, right? I mean, it's, you know, so by the you know, the 13th century AD, you know, so we're talking 1300s, so, you know, we're talking like, I don't know, 1700 odd years after Buddha passed away, and all these oral traditions and things have been written down and copied and then translated from Pali into Sanskrit or vice versa, and then into Chinese, and then from Chinese into Japanese, and then into Vietnamese and Cambodian, and, you know, all these different languages. I mean, you know, and being a former translator and interpreter myself by education, I studied to be an interpreter in New York City in the late 80s and early 90s, through the UN. You know, lots of weird things happen, right? And I'm even convinced that now with the Lotus Sutra, I think we've only had an English version of the Lotus Sutra for maybe 50 or 60 years. I think the first non-Asian language of the Lotus Sutra, and I think I mentioned this in a previous podcast episode, but and I have a copy of it because I speak French like I do English. But, you know, I think the first non-Asian translation of the Lotus Sutra was into French. And I'm trying to think, you know, like I said in my previous podcast episode, I can't remember if it's 1859 or 1959, but regardless, it's very recent, right? And so, but whenever you read well, I do like the French translation better than the English translation. It's just, I don't know, it's just easier to read for some reason. The English translations that I've read seem to be stilted, and, you know, they leave a lot of Sanskrit and Pali language words in the English text, and, you know, you really need, like, footnotes to look up, like, what those are, unless you're, you know, a linguistic scholar in Sanskrit or Pali, or, you know, you're from India and you speak a language or a dialect in India that is closely related to Pali or Sanskrit, you might find it easier to read. But I'm convinced that we also need, like, a new modern version of the Lotus Sutra that is just in kind of plain everyday English. And not only just English, but plain everyday Swedish, plain everyday German, plain everyday every language, Spanish, Russian, you know, without all of this kind of scholarly, you know, baggage in there. It's almost like the translators made it intentionally difficult to understand. You know, like, you needed to be a scholar to be able to know the meanings of all these, like, Pali and Sanskrit terms. I don't know. I think someone needs to make modern language versions of the Lotus Sutra, and maybe of even other sutras and Buddhist works, you know, kind of not stripping out of any kind of disrespect for those cultures or languages, but just because in the 21st century, you know, we need, you know, when we want to learn about something, we need it to be accessible, right? And for it to be accessible, it needs to be in a language that we understand. But I think even in, you know, more generalized terms with Buddhism, and in particular with Buddhism focused on, you know, Buddha's final teaching, the Lotus Sutra, that even though the Lotus Sutra is this kind of very complex, you know, it's almost like poetry, right? But, you know, it's not the easiest thing to read and understand, just because of all the symbolism and the allegorical stuff and the mythical stuff, and, you know, what does all this mean, and how does it correlate to other things that are being talked about? And, you know, it's kind of like you have to separate the wheat from the chaff and find out, okay, so this is all the allegorical, mythical stuff. And then this is the stuff that Buddha's talking about that is just, like, you know, just the plain truth in very plain language. You know, it happens to be surrounded by very flowery kind of Gnostic, mystical type of stuff, which I think he did for effect, right? Because he was generally preaching to Hindu audiences who, you know, had thousands of years of millions of deities and magical stuff and supernatural stuff and everything. And so I think he just, you know, he used that stylistically to get his points across, because that's, you know, the kind of language and style that his audience appreciated and could, quite frankly, remember and retell to other people. You know, if he had told just kind of very simple truths without the symbolism and stuff that the people of that time and those cultures were accustomed to, you know, who knows? They would have said, "Who's this guy?" and just walked away, right? Like kind of like if you pick up a book and you start reading the book and it's like boring as heck, and you're like, "Not even gonna finish this book. I don't like it. It's poorly written, bad spelling, bad grammar." You know, you put it away, right? Or how many times have we gone to see a movie, you know, whether that's in a cinema or, you know, something that you turn on Netflix, and you get 5 minutes into it and you're like, nope, not doing it for me. You know, one star, you know, not five stars, or, you know, like the Rotten Tomato rating, right? So I think that he was just a really great orator, and I think he used all these things to great effect. And I mean, obviously it worked well, because here we are 2,500 years later, you know, still talking about and teaching and learning his philosophy and his ethics and his logic. And, you know, he was a really smart guy who became really enlightened. You know, does that mean that he was a god or that he was perfect? No. I mean, there are even occasions where he says so. I can't remember I read a lot of Buddhist literature in there, and I was reading something the other day and I can't remember where it was at. But it was like, you know, at some point, like, Buddha did something and he kind of made an obvious mistake in something, and then somebody said, like, "Well, gosh, Master, you know, aren't you perfect?" And he said, "No, even Buddhists have flaws, right? We're human." So, you know, Buddha was not, you know, the deity that some people have made him into, right? I mean, he was not omniscient or omnipresent or, you know, all this allegorical stuff about millions of eons of kalpas of, you know, bajillions of Buddhas and, you know, flying bodhisattvas and, you know, multiple Buddhas at one time and, you know, the Buddha inside the stupa that no one was allowed to see and, you know, I mean, all this stuff, right? I mean, it meant something to people back then and it means something to us now, but we have to analyze and understand the culture and the context in order to extract what he really was trying to say, right? With all this flowery allegorical language. So, so the gist of what I'm saying while rambling is that related to the secular Buddhism movement, which, you know, Stephen Batchelor, the philosopher, ethicist, and former Buddhist priest who came out several years ago as being an atheist, and was a big kind of progenitor, you know, of, you know, this kind of secular Buddhism grassroots movement, with more and more people coming out and saying, yes, you know, we believe in Buddhism and we believe in these ethics and philosophies and behaviors and attitudes, but, you know, we don't believe in all this mumbo jumbo supernatural deity stuff. And so more and more Buddhists are starting to come forward and say, you know, of many traditions, right? Nichiren, Zen, Theravada, Pure Land Buddhists, Tibetan Buddhists, even maybe, you know, there's so many different types of Buddhism, but more and more Buddhists are coming forward and saying, yeah, you know, we, you know, all this stuff, it's almost like over time, you know, the 2500 years, the human beings, like the priests and the monks, started focusing on the allegorical stuff instead of the actual